The following podcast is the audio version of ACEP's Emergency Quality Networks Educational Initiative on Sepsis, which was initially a webinar. More specifically, this talk is about the new Sepsis 3 guidelines. This panel discussion was led by Dr. Todd Schlesinger, the Program Director and Academic Chair at Aventura Hospital's Department of EM. Let's take a listen.
To everyone for joining us on our third Sepsis Learning Collaborative webinar. And today, I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about the new, what's called Sepsis 3 definitions. But then, even better than that, we have an amazing panel of sepsis experts, including Drs. Don Yealy, Tiffany Osborne, Alan Jones, and Scott Weingart, who will speak afterwards talking about some key areas of these new definitions. So I'm going to get right started. I really have nothing to disclose except for my work here on this panel and as part of the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovations Transforming Clinical Practice Initiative grant. Basically, I'm going to give you guys a short history of where these definitions came from, why there's a third definition, some of the rationale the authors used in defining them, and then actually to describe the actual definitions themselves, which pretty much come right out of the paper. So the definitions that we even use today go all the way back to 1991 when Roger Bone published in CHEST the definitions of sepsis and organ failure and guidelines for the use of innovative therapies in sepsis. It was a consensus conference committee, and this is the origins of SIRS criteria. This is the origins of the terms we use today, sepsis, severe sepsis, and septic shock, the way we define them. As we all know, SIRS was invented here. You need 2 out of 4 SIRS criteria and suspected infection to be considered sepsis. Then severe sepsis was the same thing, infection, 2 out of 4 SIRS, and some organ dysfunction. And finally, we had septic shock, which was, again, we had suspected infection, but then hypotension that wasn't responding to a fluid bolus. And those definitions, as I said, we still use. They're still codable, part of the SCP-1 definitions now. So we're talking about sepsis 3. There's, I guess, sepsis 1. So what's sepsis 2? Actually, in 2001, there was another international sepsis consensus conference with the European Society of Intensive Care, American College of Chest Physicians, that really looked again at those 10-year-old at the time definitions. And basically all they said was these current concepts are useful. People are starting to realize that SIRS is very sensitive. They commented on that. And they made an expanded list of signs and symptoms. But at this time, this is what I call sort of the sepsis glory days. I mean, Dr. Osborne and I were both in fellowship at that time. She was a year ahead of me. And I mean, it was a really exciting time as a critical care fellow. Manny Rivers came out with goal-directed therapy. Then we had all these different targeted things at sepsis, whether it was intensive insulin, steroids, activated protein C. As I said, that sepsis 2 consensus conference came out. And then the surviving sepsis campaign, I'm really sort of brought to the forefront, something which Dr. Osborne worked a lot with. And we were really excited. But then, you know, as with all things, we started to refine it. Started to see maybe insulin has a more limited role. Maybe steroids, too, just in a limited population. Activated protein C, well, that really didn't work out that well. And then did we even really have to start looking at goal-directed therapy? I mean, Alan Jones, he really challenged that with EM ShockNet with the lactate clearance paper. And then we started looking at more detailed stuff like colloids, crystalloids, pressors, targets, transfusions. But really, the last 2 years, the three big studies of PROCESS, PROMISE, and ARISE really started to challenge the concepts of goal-directed therapy again and protocolized care. And that's why we're really lucky to have Dr. Yealy, who's the lead author of PROCESS, and Dr. Osborne, who's one of the lead authors of PROMISE here also. Why are we doing this? Why are we talking about all this? Sepsis is so important. It was, and it still is, huge major public health concern. But we do know it's the number one cause of inpatient mortality. All that's led up to this third international consensus definitions for sepsis and septic shock, which was presented this February in Orlando. And it wasn't published just in one, but in 3 papers in JAMA on that same day. Why did they do this? I think if you ask the authors, they'd say there's this concern that SIRS was very nonspecific. A lot of people would say SIRS is a normal inflammatory response. You're supposed to have an inflammatory response to sepsis or to infection. But in sepsis, you have more other things, anti-inflammatory, and we have a better understanding of pathobiology. And they thought that was really important in considering a new definition. And I think a lot of people felt maybe there were too many terms, severe sepsis. I think many of us are used to it. From the author's point of view, I think they'd say this is a lot of the reasons why they did it. And they put together a 19-member task force of intensivists, infectious disease specialists, surgeons, pulmonologists. Those key concepts come right out of the paper. That's the stuff they were looking at. Sepsis is the primary cause of death. It's a dysregulated host response. Organ dysfunction may be a cult. And these are things I think that are not really controversial, stuff that I think most people would agree are important concepts. So let's get right into what the definitions are. The new definition of sepsis, or the sepsis 3 definition, is sepsis is defined as a life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. That sounds actually a pretty good definition, but there's details there, right? We got to figure out what is dysfunction and what is dysregulated. And so when talking about dysfunction, the authors actually are using the SOFA score, or the sequential organ failure assessment. And they said that if you have a change in SOFA score or the patient greater than 2 points, that is what would be part of the definition of sepsis. This is, again, copied right out of the paper. And they found, and I think they picked a SOFA score greater than 2 because that correlated with a 10% mortality rate. So with this new definition of sepsis, it's really, this is a process when you have infection, you have organ dysfunction that would cause about 10% of the general hospital population to die from it. For those of you that are not familiar with the SOFA score, this was a score developed by Jean-Louis Vincent, who's actually one of the co-authors of Sepsis 3 back in 1996. It's a little complicated. It's 6 different organs with 5 different scores per organ. Another thing which I actually did like a lot in this new definition or in this paper was that they felt there was we needed a better term for public definition of sepsis. And so they came up with this lay term that sepsis is a life-threatening condition that arises when the body's response to an infection injures its own tissues and organs. Very reasonable. One of the bigger interesting things of the paper was this Q-SOFA score. Now, you can't go back to look for this because this is a brand new term. Q-SOFA, I think, stands for quick SOFA. And authors are suggesting this could be used on patients with suspected infection who are likely to have a prolonged ICU stay or die within the hospital. And they're recommending it as a screening. It really is just looking at 3 organs for organ dysfunction: mental status, hypotension, and respiratory rate. So we're just going to move on. The next one is septic shock. Septic shock is a subset of sepsis in which the underlying circulatory and cellular metabolic abnormalities are profound enough to substantially increase mortality. Seems fairly reasonable. Let's get a little more detailed into that. They're saying patients with septic shock can be identified with a construct of sepsis, precipitating hypotension, requiring vasopressors. So a little different than the current, I guess, septic shock is, right, they're using a MAP. They want to say pressors to maintain a MAP greater than 65, right? In the old one, it was a MAP less than 70 for hypotension. But now they're adding lactate. So we didn't see lactate in the previous stuff, but now lactate's come back to us here. It's a level of greater than 2. They found that when you took lactate greater than 2 with infected patients requiring pressors to get their blood pressure up, that those patients, if you looked at them, had a mortality rate of in excess of 40%. And these were some of the sickest patients. So this is important. You have regular sepsis, looks like a 10% mortality. Septic shock is about a 40% mortality, just to keep it simplified. And note, there is no severe sepsis. So these are really those definitions in terms of the intent. Again, this is if you ask the authors, they'll say that this is definitions with clinical criteria. They wanted to have very scientifically valid description that would also be clinically useful. And again, they were looking at patients with sepsis where they have some organ damage, giving them a mortality rate greater than 10, and then septic shock, it exceeded 40. They're proposing to remove severe sepsis, and they did it. So how did they do it? That's why they needed 2 more papers. The science actually was fairly rigorous. You know, they had this derivation cohort of 1.3 million encounters that was really derived from the 12 University of Pittsburgh Medical Center hospitals. After they derived those things, they actually tried to validate it using 4 data sets, which included 700,000 records, both from the Kaiser Permanente North California, the VA, the Kings County in Seattle, Washington EMS system, and then the Alerts Hospital Group, which included a hospital in Germany. Very rigorous methods, you can see in those papers. In terms of how much came from emergency department data, it looks like about 44%. There were many endorsements of this from many societies. That being said, a lot of emergency medicine societies, including the American College of Emergency Physicians, did not, which we'll talk about later. Some of the concerns were, sure, it's retrospective. In the derivation cohort, there was not a great deal of lactates drawn, though there was enough that they felt that they had enough science to discuss it. And I think for a lot of us who've gotten very used to using lactate in screening and in our definitions, it's a little confusing because, you know, we're now only using it in septic shock, and are we going to keep using it as much? So I just put a quick slide. There's a nice perspective piece in Annals of Emergency Medicine that's out now, which describes a little bit more of the history in detail. And you can sort of see what we call our previous and maybe current definitions review right there. Right, so sepsis now, it's going to be suspected infection with a change in SOFA score or a 2Q SOFA. And then septic shock is now sepsis where you need pressors to maintain a good blood pressure and a lactate greater than 2. And with that, I think we can move on to our panel discussion. I'll just start with Dr. Don Yealy. He is both a professor and chairman of emergency medicine at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and for their whole system. You know, I think for those of us on the call, he's pretty well known for being the lead author of the PROCESS trial, which is probably one of his 300 publications, many of which are NIH-funded. And we're really excited to have him here with us. I'll follow that with Dr. Alan Jones. Dr. Jones is also professor and chair at University of Mississippi Medical Center. He's one of the co-founders of the EM ShockNet, which, you know, I think many of us know his work on lactate clearance versus SCVO2 in the treatment of severe sepsis. Move on to folks that both did fellowship at Shock Trauma, Dr. Tiffany Osborne, who I've known for a very long time. She's an emergency physician and intensivist, does a lot of national work, both at the CDC, at the National Quality Forum. She's worked on the Surviving Sepsis campaign since the beginning, you know, in terms of research. I believe she's the second author on the PROMISE trial, and she's currently working at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, where she's an associate professor of both surgery and emergency medicine. And last but certainly not least, Dr. Scott Weingart, again, an emergency physician and ED intensivist. He's the chief of the Division of Emergency Critical Care at Stony Brook Hospital, runs their resuscitation and acute critical care unit. And for all the things he's known for, he does run this blog called MCRIT, which probably everyone on this call has listened to since it has been downloaded, I believe, about 50 million times. So thank you guys all for being on the call. I guess we could start with Don. We were hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about the concepts of SIRS specificity. I think many clinicians find SIRS criteria nonspecific and difficult to use. Are there other approaches you recommend? And being that we use SIRS so much in terms of the SCP-1 measures, ICD-10, how do you think these definitions work into that?
Well, thanks very much for the invitation to speak, and it's really an honor to have this many people interested and dialed in and to work together with the other panelists. Before I start, my conflicts, obviously I was federally funded on the PROCESS trial and involved with that, so I have not only the funding declaration, which has been over for a couple of years, but some intellectual anchors that you might become aware of. I currently have some NHLBI funding for the Acute Lung Injury Network, but I don't have any industry relationships or other conflicts. So you asked me to speak about the SIRS criteria and why it is we don't like them now and why perhaps the Sepsis 3 group decided to eschew them moving forward. And when I take a step back, the SIRS criteria remind me of something like your family or your fraternity, where you can find fault with them inside your own little world, but then you can defend them to the hilt outside because it's what you're used to and comfortable with. And I suspect that SIRS falls under that blanket right now. If you think back, it's actually an inflammatory response set of criteria. And then we were always supposed to layer in whether or not a clinical infection was the trigger for that. But in fact, over time and without any one person's desire, we began to think of SIRS and sepsis as the same terms. And that's conceptually just not right. Roger Bone never intended that in the beginning, yet we transformed that. And the criteria are really a collection of either physiologic or laboratory data, and fairly small, that would help you identify someone who was inflamed. And like any test, we had the ability to make this more or less sensitive or specific. And for many reasons, the threshold of finding two or more of these present triggered a higher level of specificity for an inflammatory syndrome. And then if you were infected, you might decide to label that sepsis. Recently, we found out, although we kind of all knew this, that maybe some people have an infection and have dysfunction with only one of those findings. The Australian paper that came out the exact same day that our paper came out identifies that there you can have mortality with only one at the very beginning of the story. All of us on the phone work at the beginning of the story, not before sepsis is often fairly entrenched and fairly obvious. And then secondly, you could make this more and more specific. So I see the real concern as trying to decide what game you're in right now. And generally in emergency medicine, we're in the sensitivity business. We want to ensure that we don't miss sepsis either in its obvious form or its latent form, and hopefully even treat people who may be in pre-sepsis or pre-shock. I always love the term pre-shock because aren't we all in pre-shock? We're just not in it yet. Eventually someday we will be. And hopefully that they won't ever transform into this. And because of our treatment, because of our early recognition, an event that could have happened will just never be recognized. That's hard to quantify, but it's an important part of what we do really matters. The problem with the SIRS is that depending on where you set the threshold, you could make it more or less sensitive or specific, and that could deliver a certain set of outcomes. There are alternative ways to do screening. I think the New York Hospital Group has a nice checklist of variables, some of which look like SIRS criteria, some of which don't, that also do a pretty good job of saying, hey, get your antenna up and pay attention to this because sepsis is either here or might be coming. But again, it has to be linked to infection, and it doesn't define it. It's meant to be a sensitive screen. The Sepsis 3 group was really looking for specificity not only for care but for comparative purposes across either clinical sites or research purposes, and therefore design things with a bit more simplicity, higher thresholds. Obviously, that's not the business that we're in most of the time. It doesn't make the SEP3 definitions wrong. It just means that they truly weren't intended to be the tool for the early care, recognizing that we may see people who may not be early in their disease, but it's early in their care. And I think the challenge for us is to recognize these flaws, recognize there isn't one set screening tool that identifies sepsis. There's a tool or set of tools that identify people either who have that or are at risk for it, and we're still required to link back, particularly to the infectious trigger part.
Awesome. Alan, a lot of talk about lactate in these new definitions in terms of where did it go? Are we really not going to be using it for screening anymore, but then using it later on in the definition of septic shock? I was hoping maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that.
I will. First of all, thanks for the opportunity to speak to the group. You know, I was somewhat disappointed when the definitions came out to see that lactate had been taken out in large part, except for in the definition of septic shock. I think there are a couple of important points that need to be thought about in regard to the fact that we no longer have lactate as a criteria for high risk in the definitions. The first is that we have published data on lactate in many shock states, including septic shock, over the last 40 years. So we have a tremendous amount of experience to suggest that lactate, whether it's categorized as a variable categorically or continuously, that when you move from zero to the upper limits of detection, that you'll have a stepwise increase along that continuum of death. And so if the concept of SEP3 was to use surrogates to identify patients who are at high risk for deterioration, I think it was a fundamental flaw to exclude the use of lactate. Now, to Don's point, it is certainly true that lactate does not prop itself up entirely on its own as a sensitive measure, but it is extraordinarily specific, and its sensitivity is not terrible. The QSOFA score in this derivation cohort had an area under the curve of about a 0.8. And if you look at initial lactate, it's about 0.7. So you don't really gain a whole lot with QSOFA compared to lactate. And I think that just in the last 10 years, clinicians have begun to realize the importance and value of lactate. That coupled with the fact that we know those patients who have cryptic shock or an elevated lactate with normotension and who would otherwise qualify under the old definitions as having severe sepsis have about a 30 to 40% rate of progression to vasopressor dependent shock within the following 24 hours after that lactate results. And so we know we can follow those lactate measurements serially, which, you know, is not necessarily something that is touched upon with QSOFA or serial SOFA scores. And then the final thing that I'd like to touch on is with the definition of septic shock, and that is that we now have a definition that requires hypotension and vasopressors with a lactate, an abnormal lactate or a lactate above 2, which I think every clinician will recognize that it certainly is not every patient that we see that is vasopressor dependent that has an elevated lactate. As a matter of fact, oftentimes if you've done an aggressive volume resuscitation, by the time you progress to the point of applying vasopressors to the patient, you may have actually normalized the lactate. So I think it's a disservice to the concept of the patient being in shock to suggest that the metabolism of lactate has to be present or dysfunctional in order to make that definition apply. So I think there are, in my opinion, I would like to have seen lactate incorporated into these definitions. I think it is something that has gained a foothold in particularly emergency medicine, but in the early recognition of sepsis. And I fear that perhaps these definitions will set us back a little bit with the early recognition of patients who would otherwise have benefited from an aggressive resuscitation, who might have that delayed at this point.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alan. Tiffany, we're going to move on to you. I think one of the questions I was hoping you could help us with was, what was some of organized emergency medicine, I guess specifically ASEP's review and thought of the new definitions? And also, if you have some time, maybe talk about the QSOFA derivation or use of SOFA. I know that's a lot.
That's a lot. I will try to get all of that in. So first, again, as both Alan and Don expressed, I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to discuss this and to talk with everybody. And so thank you very much for allowing me that opportunity. And I also wanted to put forward that the current definitions are probably the most evidence-based that we've seen yet. You know, the attempt at making these definitions, we may not agree with the outcome of the definitions, but the attempt at using data to inform the definitions as much as possible is actually appreciated, and that's a step forward. So the first question then is, who are the dissenters? I mean, who did not agree? These are the only groups that I know of, because I'm not sure who all they asked that didn't agree. But I can tell you for sure that CHEST did not agree, that the Latin American Sepsis Institute, which represents around 180,000 members, did not agree. SAM and American College of Emergency Physicians, of course, did not agree. And there was actually no North or South American emergency medicine or hospitalist group that signed on to these definitions. And in fact, when you look globally, there was one emergency medicine group, and acute care is typically considered hospitalist group in Europe. So there was maybe one hospitalist group and one emergency medicine group. So the funnel of these patients into the intensive care unit, those voices, the experience and the environment in which they work were not really taken into account whenever the definitions were being discussed. Now, you might hear the question, so we didn't endorse it. Well, should we have endorsed it? Some of the things that I've heard, I kind of got the impression that maybe the group thought about this afterwards. You know, retrospectively, maybe we should have invited emergency medicine. They have actually been quite forthright now saying that, yes, we should have had emergency medicine as participants, and that's greatly appreciated. If there is an impression that perhaps they didn't know that this might be an outcome, that should be taken off the table, because the leadership of the group was informed that it would be highly unlikely for ASAP to support the definitions or formally endorse them if their voice, you know, the voice of their 35,000 members was not part of the discussion. So I just want to clarify that it wasn't an idea of, oh, I got so involved in the work I didn't think about it. It was an informed decision that they made to move forward, and that was their decision to make. So the first question is, should ASAP have endorsed it? And I would submit to you, no. The reason that I would submit that is that the idea that outside organizations or professions should instruct us on how to take care of our patients without really understanding our environment is gone now. And it should be incorporated. That should be part of the process. I think, though, that we have to discriminate between endorsement and disagreement or dissent. So we can say, look, we're not going to endorse because we don't agree with the process, but we actually do agree with the points that you've brought forward. We do agree, and we can actually help you implement. We can help provide information to our membership. We think this would be good for our patients, and we would be happy to assist in this process. So not endorsing something doesn't necessarily mean disagreement. In this particular case, we did not endorse because of the process, but also because we disagree clinically with what was being proposed. And that was based on clinical concerns as well as operational concerns. So when you look at QSOFA, what, as Todd alluded to before, what exactly is that? The QSOFA criteria are infection plus two or more of what we have listed here, which is, are they hypertensive? Do they have an altered mental status? And are they tachypneic? And this, you can see where they talk about here, this is from their paper, QSOFA, discussing it as screening for patients likely to have sepsis. And this is the entryway into their diagnostic pathway for sepsis. So the first question then became, from a clinical standpoint, is who are we missing? Because in general, I think for most of us, a hypotensive, altered patient is not the one we really need help identifying. I think Scott, you know, Scott spoke with Mervyn, who is a friend of mine. He and I were both co-investigators on the PROMISE trial, and I have a lot of respect for him and his knowledge. Regarding the idea of one of the things that he talked about was that this really wasn't to screen for septic patients. And probably Scott will speak a little bit to that because he spoke to him directly. But I can see, for me, how I would be confused looking at this saying, well, under this big red heading of screening for patients likely to have sepsis, they're talking about QSOFA, and it is their portal of entry into this diagnostic pathway. And then the question becomes, is that where you want to start? Is the hypotensive, altered patient, I mean, take tachypnea out of the mix, is that where you want to start your diagnostic pathway? And our concern was, again, who are we missing? QSOFA does have a lot of benefits. I mean, definitely it's easy to measure. There were no labs. And it definitely predicts poor outcome. The idea, I think, as they quoted, badness for death and disability. So it is easy to measure. There are no labs, and it does predict poor outcome. Well, you remember Paul Derange when this was first described, right, for breast cancer patients. And this is where you'd look at the physical manifestations of a breast cancer patient. And they said, look, if they have this, then it's a prognostic of a poor outcome. It's high morbidity and high mortality. It's easy to measure. There's no labs. And it's got a high specificity for a bad outcome. But if we were to suggest to the breast cancer community that we should use this either as our initial risk stratification tool or as a portal of entry into a diagnostic pathway, there would be a large outcry. And I would suggest that it's something that we need to consider. Is this the place in which we want to start? Now, Alan spoke to the issue of lactate and the fact that neither QSOFA nor their definition of sepsis involves lactate. What I have here is a chart, and some of this data is their data. So if you look under the row, the very first row that shows hyperlactemia only, their mortality there was 22% if the lactate was greater than 2, and it was almost 30% if the lactate was greater than 4. Now, think for a second, because they had around 780,000 patients that were potentially infected, that had presumed infection. Of those, around 25,000 had lactates measured, so around 3%. So the data that they generated their outcomes on are based on 3% of the patient population having lactates drawn. And of that group, you can see that, okay, 30% of the patients that had a lactate greater than or equal to 4 had a mortality of 30%. And you can see that the incidence, the number of patients, was 9.9%. If you look at the row just below, if they had just hypotension, then the mortality was additionally just about 30%. So the mortality between having only high lactate in their data and the mortality of refractory hypotension was essentially the same. And I would also show you, if you look at the very top, we show the new definitions with lactate, and then we show ICNARC, PROCESS, ARISE, and PROMISE. If you come down and look again at hyperlactemia only, all four of those, ICNARC, PROCESS, ARISE, and PROCESS, they all use lactate greater than or equal to 4. And you can see with ICNARC and their database, with over 250 ICUs across the UK, showed that around 45% of their patients were identified with lactate alone, and that their mortality was 26%. When you look at PROCESS, ARISE, and PROMISE, it varied between 30 and almost 50%. So their incidence of 10% in prospective data, it's 3 to almost 5 times higher where you identify patients with lactate alone. So this just underscores what Alan was talking about a few minutes ago. Now, we talked about QSOFA and the fact that it was hypotension, altered mental status, and tachypnea. And we will submit that QSOFA does portend a bad outcome. And the question, again, that we asked as a professional organization was, is that our desired diagnostic entry point? And in general, we said no. We were concerned about who we were missing. If you look at the next one, right, sepsis, you can see that they said, okay, as Todd had pointed out, that it's 2 or more SOFA criteria, so infection plus 2 or more SOFA criteria. We spoke before that both QSOFA and the sepsis definition does not involve lactate, even though the mortality between the elevated lactate and hypotension were the same. There was a presumption here that similar outcomes equated to similar populations. That may not necessarily be true. The point being that it may not be the same people who are dying. So just because you don't get an increased predictability with adding lactate doesn't mean that the people who had that elevated lactate are not dying. They may not, having similar outcomes does not necessarily equate to those being similar populations. So when you look at that then and you see how does that message get to the general clinician, if you're looking and you're saying, okay, I'm out in the community and I'm told that sepsis is 2 SOFA criteria. When you think about 2 SOFA criteria, I can have a patient who, let's say someone presents with urosepsis or UTI and septic shock. So they're hypotensive from an infected source and they've gotten a fluid bolus. Well, that SOFA score right now would be 1. So at this point in time, the patient would not have a diagnosis of sepsis or septic shock. It would not be until we started to apply the vasopressors that they would be considered in sepsis. So now you have a hypotensive patient that is not considered to be in septic shock. They are considered to be in sepsis. Once they have a high lactate, then they are considered to be in septic shock. So the idea of the progression between sepsis and septic shock is based on processes. Have I started vasopressors? Have I decided to order a lactate? Was the lactate resulted yet? It's based on processes rather than clinical presentation and clinical progression. That might be okay, but there are concerns about it. The last bit here was that septic shock, you've divided it into 2 groups. You can have hypotension in the septic group and then hypotension in the septic shock group. we were really not sure about what the clinical utility of that was. And it really comes down to this, and this is from their paper. The SOFA score is not intended to be used as a tool for patient management, but as a means to clinically characterize a septic patient. So what they're saying here is that this is about measurement, not management. And this is the part that really was hard for us to get our head around, because when you think about most diagnoses, it equates to a clinical decision. So you've got, if you have acute myocardial infarction, you have clinical management decision. A diagnosis of stroke, you have a clinical management decision. Trauma, very different types of injury, clinical management decision. But in this particular case, you have a measurement, but not a management. And that also is confusing. If it's not going to help us clinically at the bedside, one has to wonder if the juice is worth the squeeze, if all the confusion that's being generated is actually worth what we get in terms of outcomes. And with that, ASEP agreed basically with what the author said in their discussion, which is they said because most of the data were extracted from extracted U.S. databases, the task force strongly encourages prospective validation in multiple U.S. and non-U.S. healthcare settings. So even the authors are saying, look, prospectively validate this first. And we agree with that. In summary, operational, your physician and hospital rating was based on mortality index. So if you are using a higher severity of illness for sepsis, then you end up having a higher denominator, so you'll be ranked lower. So I'm going to close with that and to just say that we do hope that we can work with the organization to move forward in the future.
Thanks so much, Tiffany. Scott, hoping you could talk about how these definitions are going to impact our clinical care in the U.S. And do you think now, as with the effect of social media, all the stuff you do you think buy-in comes quicker, knowledge translation quicker? Well, let us know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I have the best gig in the world because my only role is to take the incredible work product of folks like the people on the line right now and just try to translate some of the things we heard in the call. The first thing is Todd did a wonderful explanation of the new definitions, but every single listener to the podcast on Sepsis 3.0 all had the same question, which is we don't understand any of these new terms. This slide is the best I could do to clear it up. In the old world, we used to have a category called sepsis, and then there was another category no one really talks about, and this is a made-up acronym, but it's an infection severe enough to get you an admission to the hospital. Then you had severe sepsis, and that was clearly an elevated lactate greater than or equal to 4. And then these inexplicably created organ dysfunction signals, which may or may not have any evidence behind them. And then septic shock was relatively easy. It was persistent hypotension. In the new definition, we cleaned it up. We have just now the infection severe enough for admission, which no one's really talking about. Severe sepsis has become sepsis, and septic shock has stayed septic shock. I actually think this is an improvement, and so do the people listening once they really get a grasp on it, because now sepsis means something when before it was a wastebasket garbage definition. So Don very nicely pointed out that SIRS may still have a role, and the reason that the folks doing 3.0 have said it may not is they're using it everything for a different purpose than we do in the ED. There's really two kinds of screens. There's the screens that they care about, which is a patient admitted to the hospital. Are they sick enough to need ICU? And then there's the screen we care about in the ED, which is when a patient comes to triage, are they sick enough that they need to come into the department and have some labs drawn and have someone look at them? Or are they well enough to wait in the waiting room for 6 or 8 hours? And for that, SIRS has always come through. It's very simple to use. It's easy to operationalize at the point of triage. We altered it a bit and got rid of all the labs. This is the collaborative sepsis screen that Don alluded to, and you could see it's all explanatory stuff. We got rid of suspected infection being a sine qua non. We just put it as one of the three things we asked for. And if you had three of these things, we told people, bring them back into the department, send some labs, send a lactate. Nothing more than that. So I didn't care if it was in specific. All that mattered was it was sensitive enough not to keep potentially sick patients rotting in the waiting room. Because of IRB fights, this will never be published, but it's been looked at in 18,000 patients. And it looked pretty good. So that's the way I am still using SIRS. Now, QSOFA. Both Alan and Tiffany did a wonderful job alluding to the absence of a lab value we know probably should be here, which is lactate, and an elevated lactate does portend badness. And I think it does have a role outside of the QSOFA. Now, Mervyn Tiffany asked about this. Mervyn would tell you that QSOFA is not a sepsis screen. And he means that, and I think, if I don't put words in his mouth, a couple ways. One is that it's certainly not the screen we're using at triage to determine who may be sick and needs to come in. It was never intended for that. It's also not the only way to screen a patient with an illness severe enough that they need more than just rotting on a regular floor bed. There are certainly patients QSOFA will miss, but I think they did miss out. I think lactate should be in there. Now, what may turn out to be is that the lactate greater than or equal to 4 we're all used to is what should be in there. But just to take a little bit of the page from the new septic shock definitions, it's very possible as well, and it very well may be the people on the line who do the work to prove this, that concept of what happened to the lactate after a reasonable amount of fluid, is it still greater than 2, may be what gets added to this QSOFA. And I would not be the least bit surprised. Lactate after a reasonable amount of fluid, that number is what gets added to this middle category that QSOFA is trying to define, what they're now calling sepsis, a patient who is quite sick but not sick enough to make the definition of septic shock. But I predict lactate will be in there. And then the last thing to discuss, the new definition of septic shock in 3.0. Tiffany's done a wonderful job about talking about some of the problems of it, but I'm going to come out in favor of this definition, if only because what it really does is allow hospitals to compare between themselves in a way that's not gameable, that's not arguable, that finally gives us a baseline comparison between the Australian hospitals, the UK hospitals, our hospitals, the academic hospitals, and community. It's really finding a group that is sick and that probably will be in an ICU anywhere in the world, and you could compare your mortalities and see how you're doing. And of course, there's comorbidities. Of course, there's other risk factors that need adjustment, but at least we have a consistent definition we all could talk about. Does it mean that someone who is persistently hypotensive on pressors is not going to wind up in an ICU because they're no longer defined as septic shock if their lactate is less than 2? No, of course not. We're still going to be treating those patients the same way, but we could finally compare septic shock amongst a huge group of the population across the world and understand what we're really talking about. So just in the interest of time, I'll stop there, Todd, and I think I'm happy to take any questions, as are the rest of the people on this call.
Yes, Scott, thank you so much. Appreciate that. We do have a few questions. Some are very specific because a lot of the folks on the call are involved with the data abstraction and things like that. Is there any word about CMS adopting these definitions? They're not part of SCP-1 measure. So it's like even having a new definition, obviously we're not going to be following it, obviously also with ICD-10. Any thoughts on that? Does anyone have any insight into the government's thoughts?
My caveat here is I was on the NQF panel that looked at the 0500 measure. Remember, the measure that went forward to eventually become CMS CEP-1 was adopted in 2012 before the three big trials were out. And they specifically adopted it saying that they may modify based on the results of the trials. And that happened. And Sean Townsend and I negotiated what an amended measure would look like. And it focused mostly around measure part F, which was the reassessment part. It did not focus on the definitions because CEP-3 wasn't out at that moment in time. So CMS CEP-1 is under a lot of duress for many reasons. It's the most complicated tool that's ever been introduced for quality care. 53 different variables have to be measured. From my knowledge, that CMS recognizes that there are going to be some implementation problems. I don't have anything declarative. I would not be surprised to see CMS do a modification of how it is you collect data and extend observation for another year, but again, I can't tell you that with certainty. What I do not expect to happen is that they'll change the definitions as you're asking. Obviously, CEP-1, the CMS measure, was created when the previous sets of definitions existed, and I think the wiggle room in the CEP-3 papers, which they're trying to capture a different cohort, more restrictive for that comparative purpose, allows CMS to actually not force these upon each other. CMS is trying to treat everybody with a bad infection and some organ dysfunction, as opposed to really make the septic shock group be more comparable around the country. And that's where I see the major changes happening. So I don't think you'll see definition changes. I think you'll see data collection changes.
Got it. Thanks so much. There's a question from Kamal here, which I think I could probably answer. It says, has QSOFA ever been shown to be a good screening tool for septic shock? The real answer is QSOFA came out of these three papers, and I'm pretty sure, and I know of at least one group that's going to start looking at this prospectively. And it's a great question. I think that a lot of us want to know the answer to. I'd like to go back just Scott, if one thing I was hoping maybe you could talk to is, you know, nowadays, especially with the stuff you do and all the rapid dissemination of this information, the social media and stuff, do you think it's different now? You think people are, you know, it took us so long to really, like 10 years to start really adopting all the stuff with sepsis, and then we were already starting to prove change. You think those timelines are going to shorten? You think these things will get adopted if we all like it, if it's prospectively proven quicker?
I think so. I think the dissemination is much, much quicker with social media. I think sepsis kind of slipped on a banana peel because, or at least in the States, because CMS is totally in contradistinction to pushing the message of these new definitions. If ASEP and other groups in emergency medicine decide to adopt them, we'll still have the barrier of having forced upon us two separate definitions, one by our regulators and the other by a consensus of international experts.
Just as a piece on that, Todd, CMS, after this was released, CMS came out and said they have no intention of adopting these definitions at this point in time. Now, that could definitely change in the future. And I was at a meeting with CMS and with the CDC where these definitions were presented, and the question was asked about how they would get these definitions in sort of a national framework. And the response was, you know, it's very interesting, but there's a process and that process needs to be followed. And I think that that was probably the right way to go. And it could be that, as Scott said, that this is going to be correct and that this is the right way to go, but it needs to be prospectively validated. Right now, there are a lot of questions, and to try to universally require hospitals or clinicians to use something that has not been prospectively validated, I think would not be the correct way for the government to go.
Thanks, Stephanie. There's a question here about from Assad talking about, it's a question in regards to the SEP1 measure saying in regard to identifying septic shock, does every lactate greater than 4 meet septic shock? And I think if you look at the SEP1 bundle and the way that's done, if you have infection and a lactate greater than 4, the answer would be it does take you into the 6-hour bundle, and you have to do both the 3-hour and the 6-hour for those that have a lactate greater than 4, because that's part of the CMS definition of septic shock, which is different than the original bone criteria definition. So there are some subtleties when looking at SCP-1, and we talked about that last month in the webinar, so I can encourage any of you who missed that one, you can get it back on our webpage, where we talk about what's different in the CMS's definition of sepsis, severe sepsis, and septic shock versus the way it was originally written.
I just want to tag on to what Tiffany was saying, because if what CMS had decided was to go with the definition that all of the three big recent trials went with, which is what has been used also in early goal-directed therapy, a lactate greater or equal to 4 persistent hypotension, then that would have been reasonable. But let's be really clear here. The definitions they're using have also not been prospectively validated. In fact, it was a consensus panel sitting in a room, and just at least the current definitions, even though not prospectively validated, have some evidence behind them. And sepsis 3.0 would have been reasonable, or the definition used in process and arise and all the others would have been reasonable. The definition they chose, I think, is just a travesty, and I can't see any justification for it.
We have one more question. I think it should go to Alan. It says, it's interesting, all of the panelists discussed lactate in the setting of increased mortality. It is a prognosticator of badness. Why does it need to be part of the definition? There's a great deal of patients that present with normal lactates that are still septic, requiring admission. We're not 100% sure what mechanism leads to elevated lactate and sepsis. We just know when it is high, it is bad. When it gets better, it is good. Is it wise to include it in the definitions at all?
So I do think it's wise to include it in the definitions, because what it does is it allows the opportunity to have a more specific indicator of a patient who has the potential to progress. And it also allows for following a measurement over a period of an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or longer to determine if therapies you have provided are imparting the benefit that you want them to impart. So I don't think it should be a part of the definition as a screening tool to screen into. It's not part of the sine qua non definition of sepsis, but I think it provides additional information above and beyond what you would get from a dysfunctional organ, an organ dysfunction score, a quick SOFA, to allow the clinician more information about those patients who have the potential to go in the wrong direction. And there are a number of patients, in my experience, in my databases, somewhere around 10 to 15%, who will have an elevated lactate without organ dysfunction or hypertension that have an infection. And those patients have an increased risk also. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons that it should be part of the definition.
Oh, thanks so much. I think we have one last question. The question is, I have a group of surgeons that oppose SIRS to identify sepsis, stating that post-surgical SIRS is expected. What does the panel think? I'll just start by saying it's an interesting group to refer to, the surgeons that oppose it. I mean, part of it, obviously, is we're all bound by some of this government stuff. I do agree that you do see some amount of SIRS in the post-op patients. And I think that's a lot of what we discussed is some of the sensitivity.
So Todd, this is Don. I say this is exactly making the point in that, of course, surgery is an inflammatory event. There's no dispute. It's one that's not triggered by infection. So we're not surprised that SIRS criteria could develop in a surgical patient or a trauma patient. The same thing about lactate. It tells us a perfusion that, deficits that in some people that are not obvious. And those can happen for many different reasons.
And I agree with that. I think that's some of the stuff that a lot of the abstractor folks to get caught up with is we'll get 2 out of 4 SIRS or even a high lactate in patients that may not have infection or concern for infection. And that sometimes gets lost in the weeds. But listen, thank you guys all so much. It was an amazing group. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Thank Don, Alan, Tiffany, Scott for being part of this. Hope to continue the conversation in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Schlesinger. And I want to thank everyone and our guest speakers for joining EQUAL's third webinar for our sepsis initiative. We will be posting the recorded webinar and slide deck to our website within the next week. You may also find the past webinar recordings and further information on how to obtain CME credits on the website as well. Please also remember to join us for our next webinar on Wednesday, June 22nd, for the discussion on sepsis identification and screening. Thank you again for joining and have a great day.